So once I got into it, I realized that healthcare was my calling. I just got frustrated with the constant inability to actually impact change inside the belly of the beast.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. What do the founders of Patient One Digital Care call Charlie Brown mode? It's your mental state after the doctors schedule you for surgery, as an avalanche of pre- and post-surgical instructions coalesce into one big womp womp. Not a great scenario for following important instructions. Patient One helps clarify communications between healthcare teams and patients. Automated interactive messaging, remote capture of physiological data, and patient education are just some of the tools in their platform. After more than 25 years spent running hospitals in Tennessee and Montana, Jeff Fee jumped for the first time into entrepreneurship with the 2018 launch of Patient One. In February of 2019, the startup attracted $1.2 million in venture capital from several funds, including Revolution's Rise of the Rest Seed Fund, co-founded by former AOL CEO Steve Case. Remote patient monitoring is now reimbursable under Medicare and Medicaid, providing a huge opportunity to build Patient One into an industry leader. On this episode of Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, Jeff Fee and I talk about what's new in digital medical care and the challenges of jumping mid-career into the world of startups. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Jeff, it's good to see you. I'm glad you stopped by today.
Likewise. Good to see you, Arnie.
So tell me what Patient One is all about.
Yeah, well, Patient One is an automated patient engagement and remote monitoring platform that enables physicians to more efficiently and effectively manage their at-risk patients and get paid well doing it.
No, I want more. Walk me through what a typical patient engagement would be like.
When we originally started Patient One, we were focused on creating a patient navigation tool to actually improve the interface between patients and the healthcare system. Working in a hospital and having a literal view of people walking in and out of a healthcare facility on a daily basis, it really is a very confusing system to interface with. And it can also be very scary depending upon your personal health situation. And so when I first got involved with Patient One, I got involved because we saw a need to actually help patients navigate the complexities of the healthcare system. And we decided to focus on the surgical episode of care because it's got a real clean beginning and end point. And oftentimes when people are going through surgery, it is a really big deal, and it's confusing. People oftentimes don't prep appropriately, and after surgery, and I've got a lot of really good surgeon friends, but surgeons aren't necessarily very high touch once they're done cutting. Sometimes patients fall through the cracks postoperatively. In November of last year, 2018, CMS released some new codes that broke out from the global period the ability to actually start getting paid to remotely monitor patients.
And CMS is?
Yes, sir. CMS is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. CMS did a study in the state of Texas where they basically took some at-risk patient populations, patients with diabetes and patients with high blood pressure, and put them on a remote monitoring protocol and found that patients that are monitored in their home appropriately, they saw significant reductions in ER visits, hospitalizations, and readmissions after a hospital stay. So that's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons they made the decision to start paying for these codes. And it's good business for Medicare. If you think of the silver tsunami, people like you and me, in the next few years rolling onto the Medicare ranks, we're going to see more people needing health care, more complex care. And if you start thinking about the economics of care, it's going to be obviously very expensive. CMS is looking for ways to lower the overall cost of care and keeping patients in low acuity settings and out of the emergency department, out of the hospitals is good business sense. When these codes came out, we're still focused on the surgical episode of care, but we've shifted our focus primarily focusing on primary care physicians and other physicians that manage high concentrations of at-risk patients, endocrinology, cardiologists that manage congestive heart failure, for example. And these codes in the right hands are game changers for these type of physicians. And it's one of the most encouraging things I've seen from the government, because we have largely a reactive healthcare system. We do a great job at rescue care. We don't necessarily do a good job at proactive care. This is the first time we've seen the government financially incentivize providers to actually reach in digitally into patients' homes and monitor those that are at risk in an effort to keep those patients from getting sideways, deteriorating, and ultimately ending up in the hospital.
Jeff, you mentioned a low acuity situation. What does that really mean?
Acuity is a low acuity means we used to call it the snots and trots in the emergency department. Somebody coming in that really doesn't, it's not high acuity. High acuity is you're going to go to the hospital. You're medically complex, you're going to have surgery. So low acuity is you got the sniffles, you got the runs. Common cold, high acuity is you're going to have open heart surgery or you've got pneumonia.
And hospitals are inundated with a lot of low acuity patients.
Correct. If you look at the profit centers in the hospital industry, and this varies by hospital, but the majority of hospitals have profit centers around service lines that absolutely don't have to be done in hospitals. Imaging, labs, outpatient surgeries are all things where I made a disproportionately large profit compared to my trauma program that I had to subsidize, my mental health program I had to subsidize, ICU, the emergency department were all quote-unquote loss leaders.
Is there patient resistance to being remotely monitored?
You know, it's on a case-by-case basis. Medicare does require a copay, and so we do see some pushback from patients because there's an increase in cost. But if you step back and think about it over the long term of the episode of care, if I can keep that patient from showing up in the emergency department, my copay for a remote patient monitoring episode is a lot smaller than a copay showing up in the emergency department.
You talked about one of the precipitating, I think, conditions of all of this is the chaos around a surgical experience for a patient. And that's sometimes referred to as the Charlie Brown, you know, mode. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Typically, yeah. So you just found out that you have to have open heart surgery. That is a big event in your life. And typically, once you hear something along those lines, you start processing internally what this means for you, the risks to you, the implications on your lifestyle. And while you're processing this internally, your surgeon's sitting there talking to you, and oftentimes we say, that's all you hear is Charlie Brown's teacher, wah, 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 wah. And that's a real event. So the patient gets home, they're processing it, and they're like, what did the doc say? And so the phone calls that ensue, calling back and clarifying things that they thought they heard or certainly things that they didn't hear.
And one of the other aspects of it, I assume, is that sometimes in a surgical, you know, experience, what happens when the doctor gets in there may change. And so
Absolutely.
Someone who thinks they're going to have a quarter-inch incision for a surgical procedure, wake up and they find out they have an 8-inch incision.
That's correct.
So why did you think this could be a business to run? I understand the complexities of the surgical experience and the need for remote care. But what gave you the idea that you could make this into a business?
Well, I have to back up a little bit because one of the advantages to being in a state like Montana is that we have the ability to actually get things done. We don't have the bureaucracy that a lot of larger states have. We have unfettered access to our federal delegation. We had this big, hairy, audacious goal when I was at St. Pat's here in Missoula. That we wanted to change the way healthcare was delivered in the communities we served. And, you know, I could pick up the phone and call Senator Max Baucus, who was over the Senate Finance Committee that oversees the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid, shoot birds with the governor, was on the board of the Montana Hospital Association, spent time, still am, on the board of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana, and we had a relatively captive patient population. And with all that wind in our sails, I was like, if we can change healthcare, we can change healthcare anywhere. We can change it here. In 10 years of trying, we made incremental changes in the quality and access, but we didn't change any fundamental things that need to change in healthcare in general. And I came to the realization towards the end of my tenure, you can't disrupt healthcare from inside the belly of the beast. healthcare disruption is not going to necessarily come out of DC either. I don't think it's going to come out of any of the large players in the system, because they're just fine and dandy fighting over the size of the pie that they're getting rather than blowing up the pie itself. I think meaningful disruption is going to come from people that understand the industry, that are on the outside addressing problems that they saw consistently. So the interface between patients and the healthcare system and the complexities and helping patients navigate the complexities of care is a huge problem. And that was ultimately what got me involved in thinking that this would be a good business to get into. It wasn't until these codes, which really fell in our lap, added a significant value proposition to the physicians that we're working with.
And is that what led to venture capital's interest in financing part of what you were doing?
Yes, sir.
The Medicare and Medicaid codes have now allowed for what you are engaged in. Tell me what that really means.
So I want to make a distinction. Right now, Medicare is paying for these new codes nationwide. Medicaid, because of the state involvement, it's a state-by-state decision. So in the state of Montana, Medicaid here in Montana doesn't yet recognize these new codes.
And they're reimbursable codes.
These are reimbursable codes. So there's three codes, now four going into 2020. One is for educating the patient on how to use the remote patient monitoring device. The second is actually supplying that device to the patient. As you supply the device to the patient, there's a reimbursable event for every 30 days that you supply that device to the patient that pays the provider to supply the device. Then third, there is a reimbursable code for the care team with the physician, and it can be part of the, doesn't have to be the physician, it can be members of the care team. So a medical assistant can do this. They take the data that we're pulling in from the devices or from the patients themselves, interacting with the data, interacting digitally with the patient. Once they hit 20 minutes in a calendar month, they can bill that code, and that code's reimbursable. In 2019, when you couple the last two codes, it's about $123 per patient per month. That's a big number when you start thinking about it in the context of 5% of 1,800 panel. That generates $130,000 in revenue.
So let's talk about the personal experience. For 25 years, you were involved in running hospitals and large medical centers. You
Correct.
Had hundreds, if not thousands, of employees. What's the transfer to being a sort of a sole practitioner or a small group practitioner entrepreneur been for you?
You know, I've read a lot about entrepreneurial endeavors, certainly being involved with the Missoula Economic Partnership and getting to watch the entrepreneurial ecosystem and the small business ecosystem really grow up here in Western Montana. I was always intrigued and admired the people that actually had the guts to do it. Interestingly enough, when I got out of college, I had no interest in getting involved in healthcare. I was in accounting, and I was put on the Hospital Corporation of America engagement there in Nashville. It's the largest for-profit hospital company in the nation still, and inertia kind of keeps you in it. And I did find that, you know, there's a great way to find a really strong sense of purpose in your life when your sole business is taking care of people. So once I got into it, I realized that healthcare was my calling. I just got frustrated with the constant inability to actually impact change inside the belly of the beast. So the biggest culture shock for me was I had people and resources. I had human resources department, payroll department, accounts payable. I'm now the procurement department, payroll, human resource department. Somebody's got to go get post-it notes. It's me. Now, we do have a small staff now, and we divvy that stuff up. But at the very beginning, you got to do it all. That was obviously a culture shock when you've got the ability to delegate with a vast amount of resources you have when you're running a hospital.
Did you find it daunting or invigorating?
Both. I would say it was, at first, the minutiae was just bugged the hell out of me. But at the end of the day, if I didn't do it, it didn't get done. So, but obviously working with my co-founders as well. So it became over time more invigorating. But I will still tell you, startups and entrepreneur world is not for the faint of heart. The amount of uncertainty that you face on any given day is, it's daunting. It's scary as hell. But would I go back? Not if I have a choice.
How'd you find your partners? How'd that all come together?
They came to me. Two of the original founders, they actually came and pitched to me when I was still running St. Pat's here in Missoula. And the model that they were doing at the time, I thought had merit, but it wasn't a big enough of a value proposition to get me to move off of it. And so after I left, they asked me to come in and start advising with them. And over time, when we started thinking about this and the thought processes around the value proposition, the business plan itself evolved, that's when I jumped in with both feet.
And how did you go out and attract the $1.2 million in venture capital?
We ended up applying to an accelerator, Boomtown Accelerator in Boulder, Colorado. I think there were 1,000 applicants that applied and 11 companies were selected. The sponsor for Boomtown so happened to be, one of the sponsors was Colorado Physician Indemnity Carriers, which is one of the state's largest medical malpractice companies. And they liked what we were doing in terms of the risk mitigation that we were providing through our protocols, specifically focused on improving the informed consent process in the surgical episode of care. I think that was what got us in because we had a unique value proposition through their lens. But going through, that's a 12-week boot camp for startups. But that's actually where we met some of the people that ultimately opened the doors for us with the firms that ended up leading the our Series Seed round.
And what kind of age range or background did the competitors have?
We were clearly the elder statesmen in the group. Yeah, we walked into this pit and people started looking around like, who are these geezers? So yeah, we were definitely the oldest by, at least a couple of decades.
Investors have a formula that most of them use to try to figure out whether a company or a project or a venture is a good investment. What do you look for in an investor?
I look for an investor that understands early stage. And there are investors out there that really do specialize in early stage companies. We met one when we were in Vegas, and he says, I don't go through the middle of the expo center. I walk around the edges and I start in the back of the room because those are the kind of companies that I want to target. And when, one of the things you hear all these stories about venture capital and how ruthless it is, and it's a hard charging environment. But we were fortunate enough to find investors that wanted to invest in companies in the Midwest. They were tired of all the companies in Silicon Valley and New York City being invested. And you're starting to see a resurgence or actually an evolution of venture capital funds that say, you know what, there's great value to be had in companies that are headquartered elsewhere outside of these those two communities. And I think they have dispelled a lot of the stereotypes. When they put the amount of money they put into your investment, they want to see you succeed. I mean, they obviously want an exit at some point in time, but in the short, early stages, they are willing to support you. If you look at the Rise of the Rest Series Seed round and within the Revolution Fund, the amount of support and infrastructure that they wrap around their portfolio companies is absolutely amazing. It's something that you don't get just right off the street.
So you're getting money and guidance and advice.
Absolutely.
We are speaking with Jeff Fee, co-founder, president, and CEO of Patient One, about the challenges of digital medicine. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Tell me about the current state of digital medical care. Is it fully accepted by patients in the medical community?
I would say it's getting there, but there's still a tremendous amount of lack of interoperability. If you just think about what the federal government did in the 70s when it came to banking, they standardized what a banking transaction looks like, and you can go anywhere in the world, stick your card in an ATM, and get money out. Today, we have instances of Epic that don't talk to each other from the same company. You have to create an interface, which is expensive. And so we still have a tremendous amount of data that's sequestered that doesn't really flow through the healthcare delivery system with the patient. That, to me, is probably the biggest issue that we face when it comes to digital medicine, is there's so much data that's being controlled by these large electronic health companies that see that data and their company is proprietary, and the ability to have interoperability has not gotten there. That being said, we're seeing people disrupting that dynamic over time. The iPhone is, what, less than 15 years old, and think about how much this has changed our life. I walked in one day, and one of my good buddies, who's a cardiothoracic surgeon, has this little sensor pad on the back of it that gives him directionally accurate EKGs. Well, him ordering an EKG generates revenue from a hospital that helps support his salary. He's handing his patients his iPhone, getting EKGs, bypassing the need to actually have an order, which bypasses the revenue, because it's easier for him and it's easier for the patient. I use as an example because we haven't really started seeing the integration of sensors with artificial intelligence, with genomic profiles. When you start seeing that come together, I think you're going to see a massive revolution in how we take care of patients. But we are, and we'll get to it when we start talking about patient one a little bit more. There are almost, you can walk into CVS today and get a glucose meter, blood sugar meter, that's Bluetooth enabled, and share that data with your provider if you've got the right software system. That's one of the things that patient one does. So being able to actually pull data from the patient's home in a manner that the physician and the care team can track and trend that data over time is what we're talking about when we talk about remote patient monitoring.
Tell us, what's Epic?
Sorry, Epic is it's the nation's largest electronic health record. And the big names in electronic health records that are centric around hospitals are Epic, Cerner, Meditech, McKesson, so forth and so on. But Epic, Cerner, and Meditech are the three dominant players today.
Is the combination of Google, Facebook, and Amazon, is that going to be a leader in digital medicine?
You know, that's a good question. My general analysis of that is, as big as those companies are, and I think part of their play was directed towards their own self-insured employees and their covered lives, yet still don't have enough mass to actually change the fundamental incentive structure in the healthcare system.
And they have millions of employees among the three of them.
They have millions of employees among them. Yes, they do.
Let me loop back. We were going to walk through what a typical patient engagement would be like.
Sure.
So give me one.
So a real simple one. Family member of mine, I was kind of getting a sense that they had depression. We got him in to see a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist was like, yeah, you're depressed. Put him on a antidepressant medication. Comes home. There's a drug information sheet that one of the side effects of this particular medicine is actually increased thoughts of suicide for the first 4 to 6 weeks. Our platform and remote patient monitoring would say that's a perfectly legitimate clinical reason to monitor how that patient's doing for that period of time. Checking in with them on a daily basis, saying, hey, how are you feeling? Because at the end of the day, they truly are having increased thoughts of suicide. You might want to either change their medication or get them in and try to figure something else out, because that patient at that point in time is at risk. What our platform does is it automates the process of interacting with that patient by automatically sending out reminders. And depending upon how the patient responds back, we can create alerts saying that we need to intervene with this patient, or this patient's on track and there doesn't need to be an intervention. That's patient-generated data. If you are a diabetic and you have a Bluetooth-enabled glucometer, you can sync your glucometer with our platform and automatically pull that data into our platform. And the physician can write a rule that says, you know what, your data may be out of range on this one particular day, but I'm more interested in the trend. And if the data is trending in the wrong direction, it gives the caregivers the ability to have foresight into it to actually intervene with the patient before the patient gets into trouble. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Jeff, I know you're not a software engineer, but tell me what goes on at patient one. If I walked in the door, what's going on there?
We've got two business development ladies that we hired from the University of Montana. We believe in actually growing local jobs. Part of what we were doing just with my involvement in MEP is we want to create local jobs. So hiring a couple of talented young ladies that are actually helping with our outreach. I have a physician that works with us, writes all of our patient-facing content that he's got his own team. So anything that a patient's going to see through their device, whether it's a mobile phone or through their email, he writes with his team. And then I have a software developer that sits behind me that runs teams in Bulgaria, Denver, and Vietnam. So, and that all comes together, and you're looking at the lead sales guy at this point in time. So that's probably been the biggest curve for me. I can sell my hospital to doctors all day long, but actually taking a concept out of thin air, making something tangible of it, and actually getting the convincing someone to buy it from you has been a, it's been a huge learning curve, but it's been fun as hell.
And what you thought it was going to be a year ago, has that changed much?
Yes, significantly. I think primarily because it was one of these aha moments that when we were so focused on the surgical episode of care, and one of the things that they teach you when you're going through an accelerator is to keep your head down and keep focused. Obviously, if opportunities come along, you got to take advantage of those opportunities. But we were so focused on that particular market segment for a whole host of reasons, one of which most surgical practices are independent and they can make decisions a lot quicker than larger institutions. I mean, try to get a hospital to make a decision. The sales cycle around that is lengthy at best. And we ended up signing a management services organization. It's a company that manages physician practices so that physicians don't have to do a lot of the administrative work. And the CEO came over and said, why are you focused on the surgical episode of care? There's only so many patients that a surgeon can generate that would warrant a monitoring protocol. When you think about primary care, so an average primary care physician has 1,800 patients in their panel. If you talk to a carrier like Blue Cross Blue Shield, they'll tell you that at any given time, 6 to 8% of their patient, their covered lives are at risk. And so they actually, the payers have care management processes that go out and identify their fully insured patients that are the most at risk, and they engage with them with over the phone. They're literally physically calling the patients and engaging with them. If you take these codes and apply it to that concept, a primary care physician with 1,800 patients that's just monitoring 5% of their patient population can significantly improve the outcomes of those patients by keeping tabs on them at home, but also significantly improve their take-home pay. Primary care physicians have long been underpaid and undervalued in this country. And we put so much emphasis on specialty care, and we've got great specialty care. We got great rescue care. We have not, as a nation, delivered on health care because we have put so much of our emphasis on the actual health delivery system around rescue care. When it comes to primary care and prevention, we haven't really trained our physicians to think about their patient panel the same way that somebody that's financially responsible for them would do. So that's one of the things these codes do, is they actually start giving the physicians the skill set to build the muscle memory to start taking care of their patients by risk category. But at the end of the day, our focus has shifted away from surgical episode of care towards primary care because the implications for primary care and the implications for touching more people's lives are so much more significantly, it's significantly different in that venue.
So how do you change the business to meet what's going on in the market and what you're seeing in terms of opportunity and reward with the fact that you pitched investors on a particular model, and now that model is changing? How close do you have to work with them? What's the relationship barriers or the mechanisms that allow this to happen?
You know, good investors, especially in the Series Seed. So in the vernacular of venture capital, Series Seed is they fund you as a seedling, hoping that you're going to sprout. And savvy and experienced and mature venture capitalists that have seed funds recognize the fact that you're really early stage and you're trying to find the right product market fit. They expect there to be some change in the first year to really get that right product market fit. And staying close to your investors is obviously part and parcel. Part of where we are right now, since we have shifted our focus, I mean, if you look at who employs primary care physicians, the majority of primary care physicians in the United States of America are employed. And they're typically employed by hospitals or health systems. There's a small amount that are still independent, and we're obviously targeting them. But if you're going to get to any significant market penetration, you have to go after the hospitals. And when you're going after the hospitals, that sales cycle truly is significantly longer. So staying close to your venture capital investors, talking them through what you're learning, why you're pivoting, what the value proposition is, how the value proposition has significantly changed. Because our value proposition has changed dramatically. If I go into a urologist that's making $500,000 a year, and I tell them I can increase their take-home pay and take better care of their patients, but I can increase their take-home pay by $50,000, I might have their attention, but that's not moving the needle hugely. If I go to a primary care physician that's making $150,000 and I say I can add $120,000 to your bottom line, I have their attention. The value proposition is significantly different.
So you have a big opportunity.
We do.
And a big market.
Correct.
Are you going to need more money?
Yes.
Where is it going to come from?
We're starting with a bridge round. So what that means is our Series Seed investors, we're hoping, that at least we've gotten verbal commitments to do so thus far, are going to give us enough money to bridge to a Series A round. Series A is when you typically have around $1 million in annual recurring revenue. We're far off from that today because we're still in a very early stage. And so we're looking at getting it, probably raising another $1 million in a bridge round, which then gives them the ability to get a discount off of that Series A round. And so we're looking at probably another 12 months of funding before we go after a Series A, which when you hit Series A, that's when you're really bringing in significant dollars to actually scale the company and really fuel the growth engine.
Are you ahead of where you thought you'd be at this time or not?
No. We're behind.
And why is that?
Because we pivoted. I think because we pivoted and what we learned in the surgical episode of care is if I'm selling you a software as a subscription and I can improve your patient satisfaction, I can increase office efficiencies because our platform significantly improves the communication between the patient by using texting, secure texting. It's easier to leave somebody's text than it is to leave them a voicemail and play phone tag. And I can generate enough revenue for you that it actually pays for my software and then some. People are like, yeah, I got it. Problem is, surgical practices are building their own ambulatory surgery centers. They're installing EHRs. They're bringing on new providers. The value proposition isn't so huge that it rises to the top of the list. We have a practice in Idaho that has two contracts in front of them. They've had it in their hands for 3 months. They've said, we're doing it. It's just finding the right time to actually execute on it. Whereas if I pick up the phone, so in my hospital, my former life as a hospital administrator, I started employing primary care physicians in the mid-90s for a whole host of reasons. But my average subsidy, and I hate using the word subsidy, but it's just the economics of private practice or employed practice, I was subsidizing my primary care group to the tune of $150,000 per doc per year. That's just the cost of doing business when you employ primary care. And it, obviously, in the grand scheme of things, it's accretive to the business. But if you just look at it from the primary care practice, we were subsidizing the clinics. If I call my colleagues up and say, hey, I can completely get rid of your primary care subsidy. At St. Pat's, that was a multi-million dollar swing. I have your attention. But the sales cycle, even when you get to an intellectual yes, the sales cycle takes time because when you get into a hospital, then you've got a lot more dynamics at play in terms of how do you fit that type of implementation in with everything else that's going on.
Who's Patient One's competition?
Well, having just come back from the health conference in Vegas, which is, I think, probably the largest health innovation conference in the U.S. today.
How many people were there?
Over 6,000. I would say that a year ago, we had targeted maybe 4 or 5. Walking around in that expo center, there are a lot of companies that are just now figuring out the implications of these new codes. And I would say that right now, we've got a beat on about 20.
Does that change your thinking about how fast the pace you have to move if you want to stay ahead of the industry?
Absolutely. We have to move extremely fast. And it is when it comes to this particular market segment, it is the Wild West. And what we're finding is I've only called on a few hospitals and a few providers that even knew these codes existed. So when you're talking to potential clients, you have to start with an educational process, talking to them about it. And as you can imagine, the first thing that you get is skepticism. The government did what? Are they serious? Once you sit them down and you show how the government has progressed its thinking in terms of how they enable and incentivize providers to move care outside of the bricks and mortar model, then it starts making more sense. But that's an iterative process.
What are the security concerns about providing patient data in a system like this?
Patient data protection is obviously hugely important. And having gone through the sales cycle with a couple of enterprise clients, they look under the hood every which way, because once they integrate our solution into their platform, we potentially create an element of exposure for them. So we had to jump over some pretty high bars when it comes to data protection. So everything that we're doing, we use the Amazon Web Service. We actually have a company on top of that, healthcare blocks that we use, props to them. The whole data protection piece of it is a constant fight that's not going to go away in the foreseeable future.
What lessons from these last couple of hectic years would you share with someone, particularly in mid-career, who wants to launch a startup? You got to have a lot of advice to give.
Well, I'm still trying to determine whether or not I'm one of the smarter guys in the room, or if I'm one of the dumber guys in the room. I mean, a lot of people would suggest, you know, my daughter's she's in school at University of Santa Cruz in California, so I'm paid an out-of-state tuition. When I left St. Pat's, my wife decided she wanted to go back to school, and we became empty nesters, and I'm leaving an established career that pays very well in my peak earning years. They were like, what are you thinking?
It was either this or a Harley, right?
No, well, it was either this or going back and running hospitals. And I had certainly plenty of opportunities to do that, but I realized that wasn't where my heart was. And so, I mean, this sounds cliche, but you got to follow where your heart and where you're passionate about. And I still have a deep passionate to want to be positively disruptive in the healthcare space. One of the great examples that I used to get that I would say just to kind of shock people a little bit was, I would say, when I got my first hospital as a chief exec, and I found out we were giving flu shots in a funeral home, I'm like, what are we doing? Well, it's great publicity. I'm like, yeah, it's great publicity for the funeral home, but it's not great publicity for us. So if we're going to do flu shots, we're going to do it at the hospital. But I just have to give you, I want you to stop and think about something for a minute. We get paid to take care of sick people. So theoretic, or in reality, a hospital giving a patient a flu shot is like a tavern owner having an AA meeting in their bar during happy hour. I use that to illustrate just how messed up the incentive structure is within our healthcare system today. The more sick people I took care of, the better I did financially. I said on an investor call one time that the investor relations person actually said to the analyst, when asked, why did you have such a strong second quarter? And he said, because we had a great flu season. From a business model, yeah. But from a healthcare standpoint and from a public health standpoint, that is absolutely, that has to get changed.
Well, you have to move, as you've already alluded to, from a sickness model to a wellness model. And this is one of the vehicles that will allow that to happen in a transitional way.
That's correct.
So the three things you would tell somebody from these last 2 years.
Yeah, you like nailing me down on these
answers. I want.
Yeah. So there are new companies coming out that actually want to invest in companies that aren't in Silicon Valley or New York City. The problem is, if we had had an office in Silicon Valley, our valuation would have been double. So don't let yourself get beat up on your valuation just because you're not sitting in New York or Silicon Valley. And if they're going to beat you up on it, go find a place where you can rent a desk and have a mailing address in Silicon Valley. Tell them that's where you're headquartered, and you'll see your valuation double. That's one. I would say, secondly, and this is, it never goes as fast as you want it to go. You just have to understand that you're in this for the long haul, getting the initial traction. And everybody will tell you this, but getting your first handful of customers that will go out and talk about, yeah, these guys are for real, and your product does what it says it's going to do, that is a steep mountain to climb. Even when you have clout, I know a lot of the people we're selling to today, and it's still an iterative process. So never underestimate how difficult it is to take something from concept to market that actually get people to buy it.
What's your trajectory for the future?
So we've got good traction with some large institutional clients that I think we have a reasonable shot at signing within the next few weeks. And at the end of the day, I believe what we'll have once we get those people on board and we start seeing good outcomes. First and foremost, we want to see a true reduction in emergency department visits and hospitalizations. We're talking to Blue Cross Blue Shield about doing a pilot to help us quantify that what that really means when you do it the right clinical way, but also seeing the economics for primary care improve, which is important, and I can explain why that's important. It's important to you, and it's important to me. It's important to America that we see the economics of primary care physicians improve, because we have a primary care shortage, and it's not going to get any better unless the economics for primary care get better. And this is a tool to make primary care get better. But ultimately, from here, we intend on getting enough traction between now and the next 9 to 12 months that we will be doing a Series A about this time next year. Series A round, we're looking at probably raising north of $5 to $8 million to really scale the growth of the company and to really, like I said earlier, provide the fuel to be able to grow as fast as we possibly can.
Last question. You launched a remote monitoring company from one of the most remote places in America. Coincidence or fate?
I would say it's probably a little bit of both. But we all, when I talk to my colleagues in and around the state, we say we're a Montana-based company, that we want this to work in Montana first and foremost. When you look at just how the population is dispersed, that creates challenges within itself. And that's really where telemedicine historically comes into shine. This is not a telemedicine company. It's not considered telemedicine by Medicare, and that's an important distinction from a regulatory standpoint. But at the end of the day, we want to touch more people. We want to keep patients where they want to be, which is in their homes. We want to keep them well. We want to keep them from getting sideways and intervening earlier. I will add, there is a massive, massive, massive shift. Hospitals are going to get forced to go through changes in the next 5 to 7 years that are going to be incredibly chaotic for those hospitals. As an example, UnitedHealthcare just put out a bulletin with 2 weeks' notice that basically stated, if a provider books an outpatient procedure in an outpatient department of the hospital that can be done in a lower acuity setting like a surgery center, which they say would not be, we would consider that to be not medically necessary, and we will deny coverage in that setting. You are going to see massive shifts of stuff that doesn't have to be done in a hospital, that's done in a hospital today, being done somewhere else. Missoula Bone and Joint right here, getting in the process of opening up a surgery center where they're going to be doing outpatient total joints. Patients are going to only go to hospitals for stuff that has to be done in a hospital. Trauma, high-end surgery, and really, really medically complex, the rest of it's going to get pushed out. And I think long-term, that's going to be incredibly painful for the hospital industry, but I think from a consumer standpoint, that's getting patients into lower-cost settings, and it's going to be good for our country. My former colleagues are probably going to string me up for saying that.
I doubt that. Jeff, it's always good catching up with you, and good luck on where this is all headed.
Thank you very much for having me.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Join me next time when our guest will be Paul Gladden, director of the Blackstone Launchpad at the University of Montana. The Launchpad is part of a national effort to encourage entrepreneurship as a viable career path. Once again, I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity.